Do you go?
Yeah.
Do I go? Do you go?
I'm going to go. Hey there, Three Song Story listeners. Mike Canary here. Mike Canary, if you've seen the sock puppet, which if you haven't, I encourage you not to. seriously, though, we are just taking a minute out of your time to ask for you to support WGCU Public Radio. It is the radio station where we make Three Song Stories. It is the infrastructure that makes it all possible. And, you know, when I'm not making Three Song Stories, I'm either working here or listening to it or supporting it. So join me. Call 1-800-533-9428.
And if you want to support us, you can also go to WGCU.org/radiouninterrupted. There's a drive that we do to try to raise dollars for station programming where we don't interrupt huge portions of shows. Instead, we just remind people that we do need money to pay for the shows that we buy from NPR and other networks. So if you appreciate this show, or if you're a WGCU fan and you appreciate any of the shows that you would hear on the radio in Southwest Florida, or maybe elsewhere if you listen on the app or the website, call 800-533-9428. That's 800-533-WGCU. And just, let us know that the shows that you listen to are worth a little bit of your money, whatever you can give us.
And, you know, we have two different versions of each episode. We have the short version that only has the sort of tightened up, truncated, edited version of the song that we put out there for downloads on iTunes and places like that. And then we have the full version where you get to hear the whole song on our website. And the only reason we're able to do that is because we're here at a public radio station that has the right kind of licensing for that. So if you listen to the full versions of these episodes that have all this diversity of songs and genres, have we had jazz yet, Richard?
We have not had, strictly speaking, a jazz piece.
That's interesting. I was going through the spectrum in my head, and I realized there's no jazz yet. Anyway, I diverge. 1-800-533-9428 is the way to support WGCU. It is our public radio station here in Southwest Florida. And if you live elsewhere, consider supporting it as well because, you know, public radio is important.
You're getting dangerously close to a jazz plus jazz equals jazz joke.
I was trying to head that way, so thank you, Richard, for teeing it up. Okay, everybody, call in now.
1, 2, 3.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the place where music lovers come to tell their stories through the lens of the songs that have been the soundtracks of their lives. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. Today's guest is Jim Brock. Jim's been teaching poetry, literature, and writing at Florida Gulf Coast University since 1998. After having been something of an academic Kelly girl before that, his bio says, teaching at universities in Indiana, Tennessee, Idaho, Pennsylvania, and Miami before landing in Fort Myers. By the way, I had to Google Kelly girl, and you might need to, too. A nationally award-winning poet, Jim's now retired from the poetry writing gig to pursue life on the stage. His current projects involve playwriting and performing. He's a founding member of Ghost Bird Theater Company in Fort Myers. From my experience, if Jim's involved with something, you can rest assured it's cool. A native Idahoan, he's a big fan of Matthew Barney, Boise State football, and Peekaboo Street. I do believe that was the first time I ever said the word Idahoan. Hey there, Jim. How goes it?
Great, great. It's Idahoan.
Idahoan?
Yes.
I'm sorry. But I Googled it. Well, did I typo it when I Googled
no.
it? Are there alternate sayings of it?
Absolutely not.
No, Idahoan. You know what?
Because I'm going to be saying that a bit today. So
It's funny because, you know, I would say that I could fix that in post, but I can't.
Perfect. Beautiful.
So ever write a poem about potatoes? Or perhaps a play?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's totally a thing.
Yeah, that's totally a thing. Potatoes is accurate, yes.
Like what? I want to dig around in this Idahoan.
Well,
Idahoan?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I grew up in Boise. There isn't a lot of potatoes.
I did say it right, though, right?
Yeah.
Boise.
I Googled that, too. Very good. The S. you pass. Growing up in Boise, we had Jack Simplot, the potato king, and he had a big house on the big hill that overlooked Boise, and he got wealthy by learning how to fast freeze French fry potatoes, and that was the direct line for McDonald's French fries. So there's all that. Yeah.
So do you remember any of your Idaho potato poems or perhaps a couplet?
Oh my gosh. I had a series called Mr. Potato Head.
Oh, and how Mr. obvious.
And Mr. Potato Head had all these adventures that really were very autobiographical. So he was a persona for me.
Very nice. At what age was that?
Oh, this was – oh, my God. I was a grown man. I was like 23, 24 doing that.
Okay.
I was in Indiana and just being homesick and writing these Mr. Potato Head poems.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, okay, what was the musical background of your childhood?
Well, if we're talking about my childhood, I kind of grew up in a musical desert. Neither one of my parents really did music. I don't remember my mom singing to me, for instance. I know you've had guests talk about that. And, you know, my dad couldn't even whistle. But they believed in educating us and exposing us to things that they weren't necessarily accustomed to. So we all got, you know, when we were old enough, we got our own little record players or cassette decks. We did have a house radio, but it was always turned on to listen to sports.
Okay.
And so my main education came through my siblings. I'm the youngest of four. We were all born within 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Of one another. So, you know, just 1 year after another after another. And I grew up with the influence of my siblings.
And so what was being played on the record players, if you guys had your own little record players? Okay. Where did that music come from?
Well, we didn't get those until we were a little bit older. So probably not until I'm about 8 and my oldest brother is about 12 do we start acquiring all of that. We each sibling – I have three other siblings and we each had our own different musical tastes. So my oldest brother was probably the most conventional. He had, of course, we had the Beatles and all of that, but he had like Bread and Chicago and groups like that,
right,
that were very, very white. At the other end, at the other extreme, was my sister, and she had all the Motown records and rhythms and blues, and so it would be like the OJs or Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin. You know, and that's kind of interesting growing up in Boise and getting a little bit of exposure to that. And then my brother Carl, who's a year older than I, he was kind of into early what would become progressive rock. So I associate him also with so like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. But then Tubular Bells. he had the 8-track system, so you know I remember those almost the colors of the cassettes,
right,
that he had more than the tapes themselves.
So what did you glean out of those three different variables in terms of your own then playlist in your childhood?
Well, I think we all purposely went our own directions with it. So you know they all had first dibs on stuff. And I can remember liking really young groups like the Animals, and then a little bit later I was into more folk music. So Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, you know those people, and then kind of veering off into sort of silly rock and roll. So Paul Revere and the Raiders and, you know, I mean, just fake groups, the Monkees, you know, things like that.
They were real and fake.
Yeah, exactly.
So
they were great, yeah.
When did you start writing poetry?
Well, the first I actually can remember writing something like song lyrics that were, you know, lyrics that were based on pre-existing songs. And I was probably 7 or 8 when I wrote my first one, and it was supposed to be to the tune of the Oscar Mayer Wiener song.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, I wish I was an Oscar Mayer Wiener.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like, oh, I'm glad I'm not Richard M. Nixon. That's a job I'd hate to do. Because if I were Richard M. Nixon, I'd have to hang around with Spiro Agnew.
That's like Ken Rudin level.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. So I was a political nerd and grew up in a pretty political family and all that. Yeah.
So at what point did you start taking poetry seriously? Because you got to the point where you –
Right. I went to graduate school and got in it. Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing at Indiana University.
But like growing up, you were always writing poetry, like as a high school student?
I really got serious as a high school student. I had a really cool creative writing teacher, Maggie Ward. This would have been 1975, and she brought in Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run and just said, this will blow you away. She bought me a copy of Richard Brautigan's poetry because it was sort of hormonal and spoke to, you know, a 16-year-old angsty kid.
He's one of my – I channel the universe through him sometimes.
Yeah. She gave me his copy of Loading Mercury with a Pitchfork. And he writes these very irreverent, funny three-line poems and just a lot of fun and a good starting point for an aspiring poet. And it was really through her that I really started to read poetry and build on that. And really begin to identify myself as a poet. And in fact, one of the songs that we'll be talking about will really go into this.
Do you play any instruments or do you sing? That's not a thing for you?
I played the trombone for 2 years. I was in the fifth grade and you get to choose your own musical instrument.
Right.
And I thought, I'm never going to be good enough to be Herb Albert, but maybe I could be in his band. And so I thought, you know, the trombone would be a good support instrument.
Yeah. My daughter plays trombone.
Oh, my God. I hated
she
carrying.
She kind of loves it.
Oh, good for her. It's a beautiful instrument, but the carrying the case, oh, my gosh, it just made me angry getting on the bus and having this huge monstrous thing that prevented anyone from sitting next to me. I mean, it was like a warning sign. This guy likes the trombone. You know, it wasn't just taking up the space.
How did you wind up in Florida?
Jobs? Yeah. The Kelly Girl thing, you know, Kelly Girls were these temps for hire. Mm-hmm. I had my first real teaching gig as a professor at a school in Tennessee. And that went south. I'll probably talk about this a little bit later too. And then went to these temporary jobs where you would have 1 year or 3 year contracts teaching full time at these universities, and you would hope that you could get your foot in the door. I went to from the school in Tennessee. I went to East Stroudsburg, was there for a year. Was at Idaho State for 3 years. Was at the University of Miami for 1 year. And at Miami, I heard about this new university at FGCU. And that's what brought me to Fort Myers. It became a permanent position. And
were you part of the founding staff? I mean, it's pretty close to the very beginning.
It was pretty close. I was in their first year of hires. Gotcha. After the university started. So I don't have the founding designation.
Right. But you've pretty much been here.
Oh, yeah.
I started here as a student in the summer of 99.
Okay.
So I was around during those three building
days,
too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to your first song.
Okay. Okay, the first song is I'll first just mention what the song is.
Sure, yeah. You can tell the story. You can tell the song. You can do anything you want to do.
Is Melanie's version of Ruby Tuesday, which came out around 1970, 71, I think. All these songs that I'm going to be talking about are unified by a theme. They're about my identity as a writer, as a poet, and I'm going through a transition in my life. They're all connected to they're all physically the same. They are all cassette tapes that were played in a car. So I'll talk about the car. I identify them with very specific stretches of road, so I'll talk about that. And so, with this first one, with Melanie, this goes back to probably my junior year in high school, 1975, 76. And yes, I'm beginning to write poetry then. But growing up, my academic star was in math. I was this awful math nerd. I was taking these accelerated courses and testing out of that. I was being tutored by these students at Boise State. And I was on a trajectory to be probably going to Caltech for my undergraduate degree and working at the Jet Propulsion Lab and be an engineer or something like that. And I loved math because I was so good at it. It wasn't a set of problems to be solved. It was a language.
Right.
It was this beautiful, beautiful language. And I understood it as a language. And I liked it theoretically more than in practice. I mean, I did the problem solving and everything like that. That was great fun. And I excelled at that. But it was about this language quality to it. About the time I'm 16 or 17, I'm beginning to get burned out on that. I'm looking at a career, oh, you're going to be an engineer. And it seemed like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with building things. And I rely on engineers for everything in my life.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a total respect. But for me personally, it was just like it seemed dreary. I had two really, really good friends in high school, and they were both math nerds, science nerds, but they were also interested in other things. My friend Brad wrote poetry. He wanted to be an editor. My other friend Greg, he was this rock climber, and we would get in Greg's Datsun pickup truck. It was probably 5-6 years old. So it was actually, for a high school's kid, it was like, you know, it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a cassette deck in it, and we would drive out into the country. And on these long drives, by country, I mean we'd either go to the Idaho desert. You're near Nevada, so you're near the great Nevada basin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's semi-arid desert, or you head north and you go into the mountains. And, you know, depending upon our moods, we turn right, go to desert, turn left, go up to the mountains. And we'd go on these long weekend drives. We'd have sleeping bags, a six-pack of beer in the back, Greg's climbing gear. And we would go out and we'd talk about girls and our aspirations and how are we going to get the hell out of Boise, Idaho. You know,
mm-hmm.
We all knew that there was something a little bit better, you know, and very much being a teenager.
Absolutely,
you know? Yeah. You just feel stuck where you are, and so we would listen to these songs as we traveled, for this song, I had a cassette deck of Bob Dylan's greatest hits, so you know Maggie's Farm would be one that we would sing to, and my friend Brad had, you know, Springsteen's Born to Run, so Thunder Road we would be singing that, and then Greg had this you know greatest hits of 1971, you know, it was a compilation, and he had this song Ruby Tuesday by Melanie. And we would all sing that really loud, like we were teenage girls in the worst possible way. We were all 12-year-old girls, and just singing that, and we'd be crying, you know. And we'd be driving up this road, Black's Creek Canyon Road. It's up in the mountains where there are these one-lane logging roads, and we would just get higher and higher in elevation. And we'd be driving at night, and so there wasn't any. There wasn't any lines on the road to mark where you would fall off and die. There weren't any guardrails or anything like that. Just this black, beautiful, moonless, Milky Way star-laden sky. So it was like this heavens above us. It was just immense. And then below us was the desert basin, full of sage. And it kind of shimmered with the starlight. It was that black. And you know, there I realized, singing the song, that the whole math thing just wasn't going to do it. That I would never take another math class again. I would devote myself to trying to be an artist, whether that was going to be a writer or something else. I just knew that I would have to go in that kind of direction. And so this song by Melanie represents that to me.
That moment?
Yeah, yeah.
Did it feel exhilarating? Did it feel scary?
It was peaceful. I mean, I'm not a very peaceful person. I'm kind of like this bundle of really angry nerves.
Right.
But with that, it was like, oh, well, this is almost Zen-like. And there was this muted pain with it that was maybe low-grade depression. You know, there could be that. But it was also it really felt right.
All right. Well, let's hear it. This is Ruby Tuesday by Melanie from her 1970 album, okay. Candles in the Rain.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter, 'cause it's gone. While the sun is bright or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and then she goes. Tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained and nothing's lost. But such a cost. Time to lose, I heard her say. You gotta catch your dreams before they run away. Dying all the time, lose your dreams and you might lose your mind. Is life unkind? Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday, goodbye.
So was that song what happened to be playing when you made the pivot, or was that song a catalyst for it?
It was concurrent with it. It wasn't I mean, the other songs I mentioned could have easily been ones I chose for that that were part of that moment. Mm-hmm. It was an affirmation of the pivot. So it probably came after that, and it was just this and you know, the Rolling Stones version, it's you know, it's the choices that Melanie makes in terms of production aren't really terribly different. But with Mick Jagger singing it, it's kind of snarky. It's like you expected that he did Ruby Tuesday, you know, and Melanie, it's like, I am her. And I think that's why the sincerity of her singing that was something that spoke to me at that time too, of this sort of cautionary tale of what your life could be if you didn't pursue what you really loved.
Yeah, well, exactly. I was listening to it through the lens of what you were saying. Yeah. And it almost sounds like, you know, the line that nothing gained, nothing lost.
Right, right.
It's almost like maybe the stakes aren't high enough in engineering in terms of being a human being.
Right, right. Well,
or putting yourself out there, taking risks what you want to be.
Right. Well, it really was a leap into doing something I didn't know I would be very good at.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah, because you weren't you were good at what you were doing.
Right, 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 right. And it was almost preset. So it was almost like death there.
So what was your first step down that road? Like, what was your first active movement toward that pursuit?
Going to college, and I was first. There was still a little bit of practical side to me. I was going into environmental sciences, environmental economics, because that seemed to be a little bit truer than
right. Still some numbers in there.
Still numbers in there. but I took this one English class with Dick Widmeyer, and we read a Virginia Woolf novel, and it just hooked me, and I loved reading poetry. I was learning to love literature at that point more broadly. And so I got hooked into that. And it was really in college where I started to read a lot and then write on my own a lot, having some friends that I would share my stuff with and pursuing it beyond just as a hobby but as something to aspire to. I was reading real poets, a wide range of them, and that gave me some direction.
At what point, if ever, I guess, did you feel like you were like, I've made the right decision. This is something I can do. This is something that I can do as well as I could have done that other thing that wasn't
right.
Doing it for me?
Probably in that transition between going to college and going to a graduate program, because I really didn't know what I was doing when I was applying for these graduate programs in creative writing. I barely discovered that was a possibility. And so this is, you know, 1980, 81 when I'm doing that. And I think seeing that as a opportunity to go into like an apprentice program where you'd spend 3 years where you were really responsible for nothing but doing your poetry and teaching a couple of classes you were with these other writers who were making the same kind of sacrifice in their lives, you know, quitting jobs, putting their lives on hold for these 3 years. And that's where I was in this kind of hothouse of other young writers, you know, growing these green shoots, and everything was amplified and exciting. And I knew yes, I'm in the right place. Even if I knew even if I didn't know if I was ever going to publish a book or anything
right.
like that. So it was a pretty exciting, heady time for me then.
So when did you become involved in theater?
Oh, much, much later. I acted in high school. That was like one play, one time. And
what
then,
were you in what?
Oh.
It's in there somewhere.
It is in there somewhere. I'm pulling it up. It was the Spoon River anthology.
Uh-huh.
Edgar Lee Masters, and there were all these little vignettes of, uh-huh. you know, two students or a single student doing a recitation of the poem, but we created drama out of that. And I had one poem that I had to recite, and it it didn't really take with me, the acting thing.
Right.
It was pure pain. And
it was a class assignment.
Yes. Okay. It was awful.
So then, yeah, flash forward.
So flash forward to this would have been 2008 at FGCU.
Okay.
My good friend Barry Cavan had floated the idea that you know Jim, you might like this, and so. He had written this play for the FGCU Theater Lab called The Living Blog, and I played a psychiatrist in it, an evil psychiatrist, so there's a little bit of typecasting. He probably thought that this wasn't a big leap for me because, you know, this person obviously had a doctorate, had to be kind of academic and self-centered in some form or fashion, so it was easy. But I totally – bombed. I think it was the second show. The first show, I think I did okay, and then the second show, I completely forgot pages and pages.
You just blanked.
Blanked out, and I became petrified. I couldn't move. I started cussing on stage
in front of people.
In front of people. I mean, it wasn't breaking character. It was like, you know, they were seeing me have a full scale panic attack. You know, I was, and my poor co-star Caitlin Gravel was just there looking at me, and she couldn't throw me a line or help me out in any form or fashion because I wasn't getting anything. And then finally, I recovered, and it was horrible.
How did you recover? Did it just appear back in your head?
No. We just
moved on.
We just moved on, and I'm.
So where you had something.
Where I had a toehold again. But that was a good 90 seconds of hell.
So flash forward from that to Ghostbird.
Okay. Well, for some reason or another, Barry invited me back to do a couple more plays at FGCU. And
The Forgetful Professor.
Yeah. And he gave me a couple of challenging roles, and I really came through with that. I mean, he understood, you know, and he was very generous. But Ghostbird started with when the actors had mentioned Caitlin Gravel, Phil Hoybeck, and Brittany Brady. And both Caitlin and Brittany were English majors, so I knew them. We acted together, did plays at FGCU together, did the 24-hour festival. And so I hung out with these younger people, and they were multi-talented. They could sing, they could dance, they could do all these things. Go back answering your question. I cannot sing.
But and you do sing sometimes.
I do sing sometimes. I do. No. In public, I have. I've had to sing in plays and
sure.
be the solo and just be horrible at it, but make a joke of it. So we wanted to do something more as a performance troupe, and mm-hmm. we talked about putting together Ghostbird almost in a way that you put together a rock and roll band. Well, let's get together. Maybe we can do some things at the Sidney Byrne Davis Arts Center.
You guys are like by nature theaterless. You guys are on location for
every
show, right?
Right. We're site specific, so we do our shows now at different venues that aren't regular theater venues.
Right. Makes sense when you say put it together like a band because
right.
a band doesn't get together and say, okay, we're a band and this is the place where we're going to play all our gigs.
Exactly.
Right.
You go to a new house and you check it out and you're guest there. You don't know exactly what you're going to get when you arrive. We'd work with other artists and people in other disciplines, and we put together these performances. So it was almost like a performance art group initially. That happened to do some plays. And we started that in 2012, and we've been keeping it going ever since. We get some grants, and we have a small core audience that seem to get us. We tend to do a little bit of experimental work, and we do these things that are just really, really, we hope, are evocative and beautiful. And actually, almost all our plays, not all, but a good number of them, involve writing original music and songs. And I often write songs for our group.
How would the college student you think about you being a co-founder of a theater troupe?
he would be more shocked by the fact that I was actually performing.
Right.
The behind-the-scenes stuff, he would totally get because, you know, writing plays, that's not that much different than writing poetry, really.
Yeah.
It's spoken word, right? You know, so it's not that big of a leap.
Well, but, and I've seen you do, you know, poetry readings.
Right.
It was very performative.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's the whole spoken word movement thing and you kind of there's an element of that that is truly performative. You just have the script in front of you, but the idea of acting, I didn't know how to get to that exactly.
Gotcha.
At that time.
All right, let's move on to your second song. What do you got for us?
Okay, let's see. Oh my gosh. Okay, so the song is the Cocteau Twins, and it's Musette and Drums. Musette and Drums, right? I'm trying to remember. This is from their Head Over Heels album?
Yep, 1983.
Okay, thank you for that. This story takes place – this is a long story. It's a two-part story, so I'm going to beg your patience here. This takes place 1993. I already – so from my time as a high school kid, I get my college degree. I get my MFA degree. I get my PhD degree. I land my first – I get married in that time. I have a baby in that time. I end up teaching at this Baptist University in Nashville, Tennessee. And at an incredibly young age, I'm 29 when I get my first professorship. And, you know, I'm publishing my poems. Things are great. And 2 years into my job at the school, so it's 1990, I win a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellowship, a really big deal. It was the first time I qualified even to apply for it. You have to have so many publications just to apply.
Right, right.
And every 2 years they give these fellowships, $20,000 to about 20, 25 poets nationwide. It's very prestigious. You don't even dream getting it until you have had a couple of books. And it was even before I had my first book published. That was 1990. It was the year of the Jesse Helms Amendment, the whole controversy surrounding the NEA, Roger Mapplethorpe and his homoerotic photography. People like Tim Miller and Karen Finley were performance poets, and they got tagged because of their homoerotic verse. And so there was all these controversies surrounding it at the time I got it. And so it was in the news, and I was interviewed by the local paper, the Nashville Tennessean, and I had my picture taken in my office, and we talked about my poetry. We talked about the controversy. At one point, the reporter asked me, the reporter didn't read any of my poems or anything like that, but it wasn't that kind of story. But she asked me, well, what would Jesse Helms think of your poems? And I kind of joked and said, well, I don't think he would like any of them. You know, I don't know how much poetry he actually reads. Would he be offended by any of your poems? I don't know. Probably. I don't know. You know? So it was just like one moment. So on the Sunday paper, on the front page is my smiling face on the front page of the entertainment section. And there was a headline there, Belmont professor writes controversial poetry. And the first line was, some of Jim Brock's poems would offend Jesse Helms. So I'm at Belmont, this Baptist school. It's a really wonderful university now, but back then it was still a university associated with the Southern Baptist Convention, and the whole board members were, half of them were Baptist pastors. And so they read this article on Sunday morning about this. So the president of the university is getting all these phone calls. He calls me into his office on Monday morning the following day. And he has the article there on his desk. The provost is there, and we have a discussion about my poetry. And he says, I am here to defend academic freedom and to try to save your job. At that time, my wife then, my ex-wife now, was just on a tenure line job there. We had a one-year-old baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I got to do anything to keep this job. So he said, we will need to vet your poems. We don't want to read all your poems. We don't have time. You know, they didn't want to read them all. But just the poems that you published. And so I gave him the poems, you know, copies from magazines and stuff like that. The provost had to read them. That was the only good thing. It's this guy who probably never read a poem since,
right.
You know, and he was like a former football player. And, you know, so I was like, good, I'm going to give you some more poems to read, you know. And 2 days later, they had an emergency board meeting to talk about me. And I had another meeting. It was just me and the president. And he said, I was able to save your job, but I could not talk about this one poem. There was one poem on his desk. He had a beautiful, immaculate desk. But there was this one piece of paper, and he was pointing his finger down, thumping on that piece of paper and saying, this does not exist. And I was going, what do you mean? And he said, as a Belmont University professor, you cannot have this poem. And then he said, I'm all for academic freedom. And the poem was this thing that I wrote actually in response to the whole Jesse Helms controversy. It was dedicated to Jesse Helms. And in the poem, I quote lines by Walt Whitman about two male lovers. And they're putting and I added some lines about one putting a condom on the other. They were practicing safe sex. And so we went back and forth on it, and he just said, basically, I cannot associate myself with this poem as a Belmont professor. That was how he could live with it. And so we had this sort of tacit agreement. After that, I felt like a total fraud. I felt, as a poet, I felt I had capitulated.
You mean you think if you were a true poet, you would have stood up for it and you would have said, screw you,
exactly.
I'm out of here.
Right.
I'm going to take my wife and one-year-old and we're going to go.
All my poet friends from my grad school days, you know, and we're all academic poets. We're not that badass, right? would Walt Whitman do that? No, he would quit on the spot. He would throw it in there in his face, you know. And I was a company man. And it did all this inward. I mean, I knew at the time. I mean, it wasn't like I was fooling myself. I knew exactly what I was doing. It was a contract I was making, and I thought I can be a grown up here, you know, do right by my family and everything. And of course, what happened is it turned inward on me. I became depressed. I became a lousy husband. I wasn't any fun to anyone. I wasn't a very good teacher. So it was just this. All this toxic stuff. And so we separated. We got a divorce. I don't want to go into the whole soap opera of that. That's its own story. But just very sad, very sad. But I remained at the school. And, you know, there's adultery and other stuff. So I have a girlfriend. And this is a couple years after that. And she works for MCA Records, so we go out to all these parties, getting to meet all the, you know, the local, you know, celebrities and everything like that. So, you know, I got to go to parties where there were Katie Lang and Lyle Lovett, and that was just so cool. And she was a pretty young thing. It was like this frivolity, and she was an artist, and she was encouraging me to get back to writing again. You know, I was writing a little bit, but it wasn't going anywhere. So, but at this time, I get called in by the dean of the school, and he has, he has the handbook of faculty conduct, and he says, I have a meeting. He says, Jim, I understand that you're fornicating. he kind of just threw it out there like that. And I didn't know how to respond because I actually had something of a friendship with him, and I wanted to be kind of a smart ass and say like, yes. But he was very serious and very grim about it. And you know, he read the section of the conduct code for faculty, and you know, it was this very generalized statement, but you know, basically being good Christians, and then there was a list of things. And he kind of left it at that, and he said, "We will be back with you." Right after that meeting, went to my chair, said, "Can you write me a letter of recommendation?" He knew what was going on.
Right.
And he said, "Fine, yeah, I can, absolutely, no problem." And so it goes down a path where they're going to give me a choice, a variety of choices, and I say, I'm not going to do any of this. I'm cutting out. I quit in the middle of the semester. I resign, and I take out all my retirement money, my pension, give that to my ex-wife, or, okay, this is child support for a year. I don't know what's going to happen to me. My girlfriend at that time, you know, stayed in Nashville for a while, but I didn't have a job, was running out of money. She said, "Why don't you go to Redding, California, where my family is, Northern California." She has a brother who runs these Christmas tree lots. It's her stepfather's business. They have a Christmas tree farm way up north, and you know, get out of here and kind of clear
new scene.
Yeah, new scene. And maybe why don't you write something while you're out there, you know, just like that. So I go to California, go to this Christmas tree lot. I'm there for about 2 weeks, and there isn't really enough work for me to do. So I go up to the cabin, and I spend a whole month there. And I'm writing. I actually end up writing the basis for my first book of poetry about this mining disaster in Idaho, because she said, "You got to write something really important, really powerful." And I'm just tearing up a storm, you know, kind of refining, you know, finding myself again as being a poet. It's also she's also getting rid of me because I'm depressing to be around with, and so I'm also knowing like, oh, this isn't going to go anywhere. You know, this is also going to be a relationship that just dies. It had its own life. And so, you know, I was kind of emotionally doing with that. I mean, we stayed together for a few months after that and everything, but it was kind of a dead end. And just, you know, someone I'm, you know, just think the world of, but she also knew that I was kind of these damaged goods, but she cared enough for me to kind of push me along. Okay, so for this song, when I was driving up on Highway 97 to Tennant, California, this is where the cabin is. This is way North California, by the Oregon border. And it's a little bit like Idaho because you're in the high, on this sort of high plateau of lava fields. You have all these, you know, you have Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen, these extinct volcanoes. And it's this sort of otherworldly landscape that you're going through with pine trees. And it's winter and there's like 4 feet of snow on each side of the road. And I'm driving her brother gives me his Honda Civic. It's about a 1985 model, two-door. It has a bumper sticker in the back saying, "I am a big dick." So I'm passing people and they're looking at me, you know, like, and I'm looking at them, what, you know,
right, right.
And so I'm having this weird trip, and he only has two cassette tapes in his car. I pull them out. One is REM's Automatic for the People that just came out, you know, but then there was this Cocteau Twins, and this was, you know, 83, and it brought me back to grad school days, because I listened to them then, and they were this cool Scottish band. You couldn't understand any of the lyrics, but it was like this transportation back to a time where I was a real artist, and I was coming back to it then. And then this particular song that talks about tragedy ending and am I pretty enough, there's this kind of garbled you know, Liz Fraser's voice is this very, very dense, expression of sound. And even though I couldn't understand the lyrics, and you print them out, you just still don't understand them. It's about this emotional evocation, and with reference to Juliet and tragedy, it's like life is short. You really need to make something of that. So that kind of binds into all of it.
All right. What's it called again?
Musette and Drums.
Okay. Let's listen to it.
Thank you.
When was the last time you listened to that song before preparing for this show? Is that something you – is that a band that you listened to in life, or is that something that you had to kind of hearken back to?
Yeah, it's something that I don't have that tape.
That tape.
So I had to dig it up again. I mean, of course, what's beautiful now is you can dial up anything.
Of course.
And, you know, so,
but
upon first
listening to it again, though, right. was it transformative in your time shifted head?
Yes. I mean, what's beautiful about this is, I mean, it's all nostalgia. These stories, these songs, they take you back to that time, that place. When I was listening to it now, I was just remembering that road because I was driving it was clear blue skies. And the lining of the trees and the snow and this black rock and feeling affirmed again, you know, feeling like I can be, you know, I'm in my early 30s then and, oh, I can be back in my early 20s and be a legit artist. And there was just this exhilaration and being on this two-lane road where, you know, if I got too exhilarated with it, I could die, you know. That's kind of like the other factor that brought me back to the first song was, you know, these dangerous kind of back roads and everything like that. One wrong turn and, you know, that's that.
Did you ever have to make another choice in your career as a poet and as an artist between, you know, artistic integrity in your mind and some greater force that was trying to push you off the rails?
Yes. Yeah, we'll get to that to the third song. Okay. And there's another song I could have thrown in there as well.
Okay, so you just said you don't have that tape. So how do you listen to music generally in your life? Or how much music do you listen to?
Oh, actually, all the time. I'm married to a dancer. So she has her – I mean, a lot of it's her music that she – I mean, she's no longer a professional dancer or anything like that, but she'll have her morning routines and mm-hmm. we'll have the songs. And
what's it coming out of?
We have – in every room, we have a small it's CD mostly.
Okay.
So she has a huge CD collection.
But you've got speakers throughout the house.
Speakers, right. And we have separate music systems and all of that, yes.
Okay. Are you doing any like Bluetooth stuff, Alexa play this or anything like that?
Not Alexa because she frightens me. But we have our playlist. We have things digitalized and all of that. But we'll have to dial it up manually, you know, pushing, you know, my phone.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. You've got one last song. What is it?
Okay. Yeah. I go way out of – another song where you can't really understand any of the lyrics almost. This is Oh Death by Charlie Patton. This is something that he recorded. He's a Delta Blues Mississippi guitarist from – he died in the mid-1930s. And this was recorded, I think, a few months before his death in 1934. And Bertha Lee is his is the other person you hear in the song. We're now leaping to 2008-2009.
Okay.
About the time I start doing the acting thing mm-hmm. in theater. I'm about 50 years old then. Well into my career at FGCU, I might have just become a full professor having arrived. I had published 4 books of poetry. I was the real deal. I was in an environment where my poetry was supported by my colleagues in my university. I gave readings all around the country. And I was on a trajectory then of, you know, continuing to publish a book of poetry every 5 years. Maybe one of them, if they aligned right, would garner some big national recognition.
Right.
And at least, if nothing, being something of a minor national poet, and at the end of my career, when I turned 70, I would have a collected volume out, and you know, be venerated.
Right.
You know, if I was lucky, I would get some of my poems in the Norton Anthology of Poetry,
right.
And it would last for generations. And I got. It seemed like becoming an engineer. to have my poems etched in stone, to be taught in these universities. And again, my poems were being taught and stuff like that. And I would show and read and perform my poems. But it seemed predictable. It seemed like a dead end. And so all these things kind of came back to me. I mean, what was healthy about it was, okay, there wasn't this external force coming down on me. No, not a university, not expectations of me following a certain kind of career path. This was something for me that was, well, I'm 50 years old. I could continue doing this. I'm kind of enjoying this theater thing. I like the acting bit. And so what's happening also at this time is I'm with a friend who's going through a rough patch. He writes. He's an artist. He's someone I respect entirely. I don't want to give names because I want to respect this person's privacy too. But he was going through a particular rough patch, divorce, just didn't know what he was going to do with his life. I mean, he wasn't going to commit suicide or anything like that, but just in a difficult position professionally and personally. And so I was, because of the divorce, I was like his only friend. You know, we're the same age. I go to his place, drive over to Cape Coral. I have to like someone a lot to go to Cape Coral.
Yeah, amen.
You know, there's got to be a damn good reason. So I go to his place, makes good dinners. We drink some wine. We have some whiskey. We just have these. And it kind of takes me back a little bit to my time with Brad and Greg, my high school buddies, it's just guy talk. And we talk about literature and art and being a writer and, and he knows about my doing the acting thing. And so I talked to him about my frustrations about where I am as a writer. I'm listening to his problems and everything like that. And he said, "Well, do you have to die being a poet?" "No, I don't have to." He said, "Well, there are other writers who've taken these leaps, and because I started talking about maybe writing a play and doing that, but not having. Usually when I bring that up to other people, they think of it in terms of, oh, you're going to write a movie script or, oh, this is going to be on Broadway. And I was talking about this in terms of doing things that, maybe Barry Cavan might do for me or, this was before even Ghostbird started. But I'm hanging around with also these young kids, Caitlin, Phil, and Brittany, and they're doing all this creative stuff. And I thought, this is maybe where I can be renewed. And then professionally, it was also I was already a full professor. I didn't have to prove myself to anything. I have a chair, Kim Jackson, who understands all of that, who said, this is cool. Go off in your own direction. If I were teaching at another university, it would be, what are you doing? You can't do that. You have this is where you've established your national reputation. You got to
– Right. Yeah. You're
right. So this was a change where it was like, no risk other than giving up what I had always done.
Right.
And trying something.
Personal comfort.
Yeah, something maybe. New. And so the plays that I've been writing since then have been for this very small theater company. I have no intention of ever publishing them, no intention of having another theater company produce it. Theater to me, performance is all about this moment. You give it to the world and then it disappears. It's not a text that you can come back to and read again. And it's this generous offering that you work really, really, really hard to produce. So I'm at my friend's house and we're talking about this, these things about the ephemeral nature of theater and, he almost like my girlfriend from way back in, in California just said, well, do it, And you realize it's not that hard to do. And so I was driving. This is, again, a specific moment. I'm driving my own Nissan 1995 red pickup truck. No air conditioning. It's my Idaho truck. It's about to die. and it has a cassette deck in it. So it's antiquated already then, 10 years ago. And I'm driving over the Cape Coral Bridge. And I still have this tape of Charlie Patton's songs. And as I was driving over the bridge, this song, Oh Death, came on. And it's something of the same song as Melanie's song, almost the same song as the Cocteau Twins song about I'm not long for this world. And it just reminded me of what's at stake here. You know, I mean, on some level, it's inconsequential. If you're going to write a play and it disappears into the ether, it's nothing. But it's also simultaneously everything.
Well, let's hear it. This is Oh Death by Charlie Patton as Jim drives across the Cape Coral Bridge.
Lord, no, my time ain't long. You know, it's just that.
What time of year was it? I ask because I'm wondering if you were comfortably un-air-conditioned or uncomfortably un-air-conditioned.
Oh, it was this was wintertime, so it was very comfortable.
Oh, it was beautiful.
So it was beautiful, yeah. And it was going over the bridge at night. And, you know, it's also just this song kind of being a miracle being produced anyway, because it's just months before he dies. Mm-hmm. He knows he's dying of some kind of heart disease. He's in horrible shape physically from the illness or what he's suffering from. He's with his eighth wife, who is this remarkable gospel singer, and it's just the two of them and his his bottleneck guitar. And just saying like, okay, I'm going to keep on doing this till I die.
Mm-hmm.
And so in part, that's what any writing for me is doing, you know, is about. And whether it's the poetry or the playwriting. You know, just this sort of defiance of creation that you're going to keep on doing it no matter what is inspiring. And that's, you know, what's you know, beyond just the message of the song itself, it's almost this almost gospel inspired song about death, but it's also about this resilience that we all have, or if we choose to tap into that. Yeah.
Do you still write some poetry for yourself, or have you left it sort of off the table for the time being?
It's off the table professionally, is right. What I tell people. So I'm not actively publishing my poetry. I'll write poems that might become monologues in plays. I might write poems that are standalone unto themselves. Sometimes I write occasional poems, or I have to just respond to the world because, you know, the poem is easier to do than like, okay, I can write a play about that. Well, you know, 9 months later, I might have something, a poem. It's a weekend later and I'm good with it. Yeah.
Is there a song that you will always turn off that comes on the radio?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, dear me. Always, always. Not that I listen. Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, I mean, there's several. I mean, it'll be like, oh, God. Okay. Lee Greenwood's, what's that song? America, Stand Up America.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That goes – that's
– Do you listen to the kind of stations that risk the exposure of that song?
Not a lot. Not a lot. But sometimes – well, no. Actually, I like some country western stuff. I mean, really, because I lived in Nashville and everything like that. And my parents – I mean, the one music we had when we were young, we'd go up to this up where our cabin was. There was a lodge and they had a Saturday night stomp, and it was like my parents would get a pitcher of beer, they would drink it, we'd get a pitcher of Coke, we'd play pool, they'd be on the dance floor to Conway Twitty or Jimmy Rogers or something like that, really twangy and old, and they danced. It was miraculous. So, you know, I kind of, you know, there were not anymore, not likely, you know,
right.
And that's such an old song, but it was so dominant at one point.
Yeah, it was pervasive.
And, yeah, everywhere. And it was just like, oh, gosh, the worst jingoism possible, the obligatory patriotism of that, and it just being a horrible, I mean, it's just bad over, you know, the whole Nashville sound thing. And you just want to, yeah, that's one where I violently turn it off. I mean, I might, you know, do damage to the radio.
Right. Last question. If you can perform on stage with any person, living or dead, who would it be?
Wow. Perform.
As an actor.
Oh, okay. Oh, geez. Just to see her work would be Helen Mirren.
Oh, okay.
And just stare at her. I mean, that's we're talking about a very old, lifelong crush.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to be in her radiant presence.
Yeah. And just to see her work. And just, yeah, I've loved her since the late 70s. So that's kind of like a lifelong thing, just admiring her as an actor, but also someone who's resplendently beautiful from my perspective.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, that is all the time we have. Jim,
okay.
Do you have any final thoughts to leave us with?
Actually, I have a question for you.
Okay. I'll try to do my best.
So, and you can be totally evasive here. Holy cow. So this is like the 20-some-odd time you've done this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means you've listened to 70-some-odd songs.
Mm-hmm.
And you are very professional, sir. And it could have happened right when I was doing my little thing. But, you know, have you – when somebody's come up with a song and I know you respect and love every person, but – you're like, oh, my God, this is horrible.
You know, I would say no. I would say that I have appreciated every song. I've learned a lot about the need to appreciate music. And I don't mean like just because, I mean, I've had quite a few people who've really talked about, you know, maybe I used to be snarky about music,
but I
realized, you know, it's art. We should love all art, right? And so I think I've been broadened in that way, and I've listened to definitely a lot of songs I would have never heard otherwise. And I'm just going to leave it with this. We have a production intern now, DP Workman, and he has gone through every episode of Three Song Stories, and he's created Spotify playlists for all the guests, and we have one master Spotify playlist that we're about to put on the website. So we're basically creating a Three Song Stories radio station with the guests' choices. That's my answer.
Okay. Appreciate that. I really do appreciate that, because there would be some time when I go like, what?
Yeah.
Well,
and just, I mean, as a final thought, I go out and find the music and I prepare it for the show, but I don't listen to it. So unless it's a song I'm familiar with, like those songs I just listened to with you are all versions I'd never heard before. So I listened to those all for the first time today.
Oh, cool.
So,
cool.
Anyway, thank you, Jim, so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. It's just grand. Just grand. Thank you.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is the show's co-creator and producer. Our online content producer is Tara Callaghan. Our executive producer is Chris Duffus. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio up in St. Pete. For my parting tune this week, I'm going back to dawn breaking on Fort Myers Beach at the end of 2011. I'd left my job as Morning Edition host at WGCU earlier that year, so was up before the sun every day, whether I liked it or not, but I mostly did like it. Nothing like a sunrise sometimes. I remember this morning extra clear because I have evidence. I'd recently gotten my first digital SLR that could shoot video and had been experimenting. That morning, I shot a sort of off-the-cuff music video using this song. I propped the camera up on the dash of my old Jeep Cherokee as I drove south on Estero Boulevard toward the end of the island as this song played. Besides having left my longtime job in radio, I'd also just left my first real relationship that I'd been in since parting ways with my daughter's mother more than 3 years before. So that newly ended love was still swirling in my mind as this song played as the world slowly awoke. This is Pamphleteer by the Weaker Thans. Great poet, this guy. By the way, enterprising listeners can find the video I made on my YouTube channel if you're interested in sharing that moment with me. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
Why do I still see you in every mirror? this room in time to the beat of the Gestetner. Contemplate my next communique. The rhetoric and treason of saying that I'll miss you, of saying,
any final thoughts, and can you give them to me in a robot German accent?
No, I can't. There's not enough alcohol in this building.
Okay.